boxed out gas. We want the exotic, erotic ladies, not them toxic ladies that burn a lot. I learned a lot from junkies to ruffians, from being tied up by Colombians, cause 80 grams was missing. Listen, had to change my position from wanting to be large to head in charge. My garage, call it CeeLo, 4 5s and 6s, honeys by the mixes. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. Smoke out with Leo, Biggie, Tarantino. Size like a sumo, Frank White, numero uno. Can't stop, won't stop. Individual. Who wanna test it? Foreign or domestic? No matter where you're from, I'm not the one you wanna mess with. Original, with the style, living lavish. Private jets to let my shorty shop in Paris. I'm not the average, I'm far from the norm. It's daddy long, hitting them strong, keeping you warm. Alive to a lemon, my DC women. Bringing in 10G minimums to condos with elevators in them. Vehicles with televisions in them. Watch they entourage turn yours to just mirages. Disappearing acts, strictly nines and max. Killers be serial, Copperfield material. My dreams is vivid, work hard to live it. Any place I visit, I got land there. I can play a stand there and say I sound like them. Hello, push wings back and push six coupes, that's yellow. Plus clips to expand from hand to elbow. Spray up your days in any teller you in. Crack bragging, sick of bragging, how my make be dragging. Desert East Street sleep inside the Beamer wagon. I rely on Bed-Stuy to shut it down if I die. Put that on my diamond bezel. You're messing with the devil. Why? Can't stop, won't stop. Can't stop, won't stop. Can't stop, won't stop.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Hey folks, this is Rohith Joseph, co-director of News 101. It's almost the end of final exam season here at UBC, and with that, we're bringing you the closing episode of our News 101 season. Picking up right where we left off from last week, we have some of our best interviews and panel discussions to wrap up News 101. We'll kick things off with News 101 correspondent Lauren Calger and her interview with Ugo Lapointe from Mining Watch.
In a mine, where a million diamonds shine. We dig, 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 from earth on to mine.
This is Lauren Calder reporting from the Climate and Environment Desk here at News 101. I am here today with Ugo Lapointe of Mining Watch Canada, and he is in British Columbia today to tell us all about what we should know about mining here in BC. Hi, Ugo. What are you doing here today?
So it is part of my mandate to tackle mining issues all across Canada. Canada is a powerhouse for mining internationally, but we do also a lot of mining domestically. And the three main mining jurisdictions in Canada right now are Quebec, Ontario, and BC. Mm-hmm. And so I intend to spend quite a bit of time in BC during this mandate that I just started with Mining Watch this year. I'm hoping to come here maybe two or three times a year, spend a few weeks connecting with communities that are affected by mining, First Nations communities, but also non-First Nations communities, connecting with policymakers, lawmakers, and different civil society groups, environmental groups, in the hope to effect positive changes in the way mining is being regulated and mining is being conducted environmentally, socially, and in terms of human rights and First Nation rights perspectives.
Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of us here in the city, we don't necessarily, we're not so much involved with mining. But BC, as you said, is a pretty big player. Can you give us some idea of what kind of mining operations are in BC?
The important thing to keep in mind is that try to have a perspective on the global trends of mining and where do we fit as citizens that consumes metals. What we're seeing over the last 10 to 20 years is that there's more and more mines on the planet digging for metals. The mines are becoming bigger and bigger, but the grades, the quality of the metal in the rock is actually diminishing. There's less and less metals. Often the average is way below 1% of the rock that you extract is actually metals. So 99% is actually waste that you need to store on the land forever. And you need to make sure that that waste doesn't spill anywhere. So we're on a trend where the environmental impacts related to water consumptions, to energy consumption, to footprint of those mines is getting bigger and bigger when there are communities around that are affected more. And you also see increasing human rights issues as well across the planet. So I think we're at a stage that, a bit like the climate justice, like energy issues have done over the last 10, 15 years, we need to start thinking about the mineral mining metals impacts and how we can affect the positive change. And one of those areas is probably we need to start thinking of reducing some of those metal consumption in our lives. And, you know, it's going to be different depending on the metal. You talk about, you know, gold is certainly a big industry, probably 30 to 40% of all mines on the planet are gold mines. But what is gold, used for? Well, primarily jewelry. So maybe we need to think about that. Whereas iron is, and copper and nickel is different. That's primarily used for urbanization, city building, industrialization, some electronics, which have a different purpose for societal needs. And So with this in mind, you know, Canada then and BC in particular need to think about improving its overall footprint from mining.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be tackled from different angles. And one of the some of the angles that we work on is policy and regulatory reforms for better protections of people that are around mines, better protection of the environment, community support. So those that are affected by mining can get a proper support, technical support, or strategic support when facing choices of mine near their communities. And then the other angle is corporate accountability. So it means like targeting companies, shareholders, companies' boards to try to make them accountable for their choices and the way they operate mines.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we think of mining regulation here in BC, most people tend to think of the Mount Polley disaster, which happened in 2014, August, right?
Right.
Can you give us a bit of background of that disaster and the ongoing issues around that?
Yeah, I mean, like the Mount Polley disaster was the biggest mining spill in the history of Canadian mining, and probably one of the biggest environmental spill in the whole history of Canada. We're talking about nearly 20, 25 billion liters of liquid and solid waste that was spilled and destroyed the Hazelton Creek over almost 10 kilometers long, and then spilled into Quesnel Lake in the Quesnel watershed downstreams, which eventually reached the Fraser River. The immediate impacts were water bans for a few days or weeks, and then, of course, instant killings of all the animals that were in the way of that massive spill. But the long-term impacts are still unknown. There's a lot of contaminants that went into the watershed that may affect future salmon fishery and so on. There's also impacts that were on the local businesses, whether they be, you know, recreational, touristic, fishing, hunting businesses that were in the area. And, of course, the impacts on the First Nations people that use the land or have a deep spiritual connection with that land were very affected by that spill. Now, a year later, where we're at, well, in terms of the reaction from the government did recognize there was a problem. They did commission a technical report that was published in January, which assessed what happened. And they also suggested, that report also suggested, to change a lot of the regulations and the way mining tailings are being operated. So there is currently an ongoing review of the what we call the mining code to see what we can change in terms of tailings management. Mm-hmm. We're still a bit concerned about the direction that it's taking. There's some positive step being done by the BC government, but probably not enough. So that's why a lot of our work in 2016 will try to focus to push the government for greater changes and with these massive wet tailings pond, which we should try to avoid at all costs with, and going with alternatives which are less risky. And just recently, like 2 weeks ago, there was another major spill in Brazil, Samarco, another mine. But again, that reminds us that this issue is not only a BC issue, it's a global mining industry issue. And while BC is reviewing its regulations now, we also need to push internationally and in other countries to do the same, so that overall the global industry, mining industry, is doing a better job at protecting the environment and the communities around.
Because a lot of mines are based in Canada that operate internationally. So,
in fact, 60 to 70% of all mining companies across the planet are registered in Canada in one of the stock exchanges, whether it's in Toronto or Vancouver. Mm-hmm. It's become a specialty of Canadian business. So that means, in our opinion, that we have then a higher responsibility as a Canadians to make sure that this industry is not destructive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you notice any differences between how BC regulates its mining compared to other Canadian provinces?
Absolutely. And, I wouldn't say that there's one province that is perfect. I think there is positive or more progressive or higher performance criteria in some other provinces. So, for example, Quebec just changed its mining laws over the last 2-3 years. They now require greater financial assurance prior to mining. That means that there is money set aside for in case the mining company goes bankrupt, and then we need to clean up that site, because there's always a site to clean up after. BC is not quite that same level of financial assurance. That's a problem, because you and I and taxpayers in BC are on the hook. If Montpellier Imperial Metals go bankrupt tomorrow, we inherit the bill to clean up everything. There is also improvement that we're done in Quebec regarding community choices. So now municipalities will be able to designate no-go zones for mining in their territory. So zones that are too sensitive ecologically or economically or socially will be out of bound for mining. And that is a major issue in all across Canada. Letting community do proper land use management and designate areas where mining could go and others that it should not go. And BC does not allow that, actually. So most of the BC land, over 80%, is open to mining, and the communities have practically no legal means to say no to mining.
Wow. Okay, well, thank you so much for your insights. Any last thoughts? I know you're trying to, again, there has been trends, as you mentioned, towards this kind of self-regulation. You're trying to rebalance that through the work of Mining Watch.
That's right. The self-regulation is an issue where over the last decade we let the industry control its own operation, control its own pollution monitoring, and so on. And so And that is out of balance. We need to come back to a more oversight from the government and the ministries. And that was part of the lessons from the Mont Poly disaster, too. But that's also clashing with the trend that we've seen across governments in Canada, where governments want to cut in their budget year after year, reduces expenses. But that logic has its limitation when you don't have any more expertise in the ministries to do the job they're supposed to do, that is protect the public interest, protect the environment, and protect the communities that are around potentially dangerous industries.
Our next piece takes a look at welfare. Darren Dahl, Senior Associate Dean of the Sauder School of Business at UBC, is the lead author of a welfare study that found welfare recipients are perceived as being less moral when buying more expensive ethical products, such as organic produce. I spoke with Professor Dahl in March about the stereotypes that welfare recipients are confronted with and the difference between the welfare offered in the United States and here in Canada. Why specifically pick the United States?
Well, largely because they have strong opinions on the notion of welfare, and this is where we were seeing these types of restrictions pop up. We haven't seen the same type of phenomenon in Canada, as example, though it is possible that these types of attitudes do exist among Canadians. We haven't tested that specifically, but in the U.S., it just seemed to be an interesting or a fertile ground to test these types of questions.
So what was the most startling finding for you as a researcher?
Well, a couple things. Number one is looking at the mechanism or why this happens. And what we found was that the reason, society or people on average would look down on someone on welfare buying these types of products was because they felt, these individuals didn't earn the right to. They didn't earn the money. So when we looked at, other people that didn't have income resources, so, you could say poor people, but that had earned the money, you didn't get the same negative attributions. It was only when, you had received the money from the taxpayer that you would be perceived as in a negative way. And the other interesting thing that we found was that this extended to organizations. So one of the last studies we did was people would judge, a charity in a negative way if they were helping people by giving them organic or fair trade, these types of products. So the effect didn't just localize on individuals, but also on organizations that were providing welfare recipients with these types of products.
That's actually what caught my eye most interestingly, is that it's extended to organizations. Why do you think that is?
Well, just it again comes down to the dollars, right? In that, these dollars, as an organization, should be spending them not on products, that are more expensive. Yes, they're probably better for society, but, you're giving them to people on welfare, therefore you should be more judicious with your dollars.
Even if these organizations are not using taxpayers' money, this is for non-governmental, right?
Yeah, but this is still money that you're using that was given or donated or whatever by me, the taxpayer. If that makes sense. So the whole fact is, these individuals didn't earn that money. They were given that money, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Don't you spend my money on what some people, and this is also kind of interesting, what some people would say is, frivolous or extravagant or not always necessary in terms of organic.
You were saying earlier that although this hasn't been tested in Canada, it's possible. What are your personal thoughts about why there might be a difference between Canada and the U.S., or if there is a larger difference?
Well, it comes down to how we view the notion of welfare, and obviously in the U.S., welfare, the perception that a lot of people on welfare are just lazy and they just need to go get a job, those types of stereotypes, which, aren't really true, those are much stronger in the U.S. than in Canada. And Canada has a much longer and a perhaps one could argue more robust history of the notion of a social safety net. And so I think the notion of welfare and helping people in this way is a little bit more amenable or a little more acceptable, to a Canadian taxpayer. That being said, I do think you'd get, some segment of the population would share the similar the similar perceptions that we picked up in the U.S. There's a lot of variability on this, right? Not everybody's going to have the same view, but when you look, you know, on the average, these effects do show up quite strongly in the U.S.
In the U.S., did you manage to get a broad geographical sampling? Because, of course, the attitudes would range depending on the region, I would assume.
Mm-hmm. So the studies were run in a number of locations, so in Arizona, in Michigan, and then we've run studies also using the MTurk panel, which is a broad cut of America. So it's fairly robust as an average point, but I agree with you. I think in some states you're probably going to get a stronger effect than in others, you know, and I think we could guess what that would be based on the stereotypes that we have of these specific states. But, you know, we didn't test that, but I think that would be a reasonable hypothesis to make. But until you did it empirically, I think we always have to be careful, but I think your intuition is correct here.
Seeing as you're coming from a marketing background, what would the use be for companies, or I guess organizations, charities, with this research? How do you think they might respond or adapt?
Well, sir, first off, I think just having an awareness that these types of attitudes exist is very valuable to charities and organizations that are working with welfare. So, you know, knowledge is empowerment. So first off, it's a good idea to have an awareness that these effects exist. And second, it speaks to charities in terms of how they do their messaging. So, you know, if they are buying fair trade or organic and see value in those types of choices, you know, making sure that, you know, the people that donate and interested parties, you know, see the value in doing so, number one, and two, you know, playing with things that can reduce the effect, like price, for example, and saying, you know, we are buying organic, but it's the same price as if we buy, you know, full-fat hamburger, so to speak. And then it becomes much more acceptable to a donor to say, well, look, I mean, it's the same price, I'm getting the same bang for my buck. We should obviously choose organic because there's no disadvantage on the dollars at all. And so by being aware of these types of effects and the attributions that exist, you know, it helps the charity with their messaging and how they actually appeal to consumers that might have these concerns.
And speaking of then the consumers, the individual consumer, do you have any hope or ideal that your research might influence them in any way?
Well, I mean, obviously that would be really positive too. I think being aware that these stereotypes and attributions exist is the first part of the equation, so to speak. And once people, you know, are aware of these things and think a little bit about it and ask themselves, okay, is this good or is this bad? And I can't say which way they're going to go. I think awareness of the fact that this happens is clearly the first thing that you want to get out there. And then people can make up their own mind and hopefully think a bit about it. So I think when you think a little bit about it, you can then have a good debate in your head or certainly with people, friends, spouses, colleagues, whatever the case may be.
Just to close things off, bringing it back to, you know, Canada, and particularly in Vancouver, there is definitely inequality. So What can we take as a community here in Vancouver? What can we take from this research?
Well, I think, I mean, at a more macro level, you know, inequality does create attributions. And so we are going to have opinions and stereotypes of any type of group, right? Mm-hmm. And being aware that stereotypes can be a very bad thing, right? And sometimes they lead, you know, to conclusions and things that we do that may not be in the best interest of society as a whole.
We certainly have stereotypes here about the downtown east side, for example.
100%. And you know, how true those are, you know, I think it's on us to truly try to understand and maybe spend some time to get better informed. And I think, you know, that could be a message here in this market is, you know, this type of research, yes, done in the U.S., has some application here, may not be the exact same, but it makes the point that, you know, attributions and stereotypes do have meaningful outcomes. And being aware and having a better understanding of as you said, you know, an impoverished group like the Downtown East Side is going to benefit society and benefit individuals.
All right. Thank you so much, Darren. Is there anything you'd like to add for our listeners?
No, I think it's great that the station is interested in some of the research coming out at UBC and definitely enjoyed the conversation and thank you for asking great questions.
Oh, no problem. Thank you, Darren. Take care.
All right, take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.
The verdict of the Gian Gomeshi trial drew both criticism and praise in the mainstream media. Here at News 101, we decided to have a panel discussion that sorted through the arguments for and against the verdict. The panel featured Sarah Lapsley, the former director of the Arts Report on CITR, co-director of News 101 Emily Blake, and News 101 correspondents Sam Moore and Eva Uguen-Senge.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Now we have our discussion panel on the Gian Gomeshi verdict.
Thank you, Sam and Eva. This is Rohit Joseph, co-director of News 101, and we also have my fellow co-director, Emily Blake, joining us. And a very special guest is joining us in the studio, my former mentor from the Arts Report, Sarah Lapsley. Can you introduce yourself to the good people?
Hi, thank you. I'm Sarah. I'm here to talk about the Gian Gomeshi case. I work as a counselor in correctional mental health, so I did my master's here at UBC. So I work with clients who have perpetrated crimes, and so a lot of this kind of issues are familiar to me. It was very interesting and a lot of food for thought.
Mm-hmm.
So I was excited to come talk about it.
So what made you particularly invested in wanting to talk about it, the Gian Gomeshi case?
I think partially I'm just interested in crime, so I like to read about it and think about it and sort of analyze it. From a psychological standpoint, Gomeshi is a complicated person, I think a predatory and dangerous person. I've done a lot of reading about psychopathy and narcissism, and one of the world's experts on psychopathy and narcissism, Robert Hare, actually is from UBC, and so I read a lot about people like this in our midst and how to avoid them and how to see them. So I have a special interest really in psychological self-defense, in terms of how to avoid people like this. And I recently had a boss who was similar to Gomeshi in character and was involved in the whole process of bringing this person, you know, to light. And it was a very difficult experience. So I definitely have sympathy for the difficulty, you know, in dealing with people like this. So he's definitely an exploitive, abusive person. And I was actually unpleasantly surprised by the results of the trial yesterday.
Before we get into the results, and we're going to open the floor at that point for a discussion, why don't you just kind of briefly tell listeners, catch them up on what's been happening with the Gian Gomeshi case?
Yeah, well, it just sort of broke in, I guess, November 2014 with this Facebook post, sort of a preemptive Facebook post where he claimed that angry ex-girlfriends were bringing these false allegations against him. I felt it was like a very bizarre, hysterical post, and then it sort of exploded in terms of being fired from the CBC. And then all these things came to light about his past history of very concerning, disreputable behavior, a bully, exploitive, sexually aggressive and assaultive. I think up to 23 women and one man alleged that he had hit them in the course of like an interpersonal interaction. And there were rumors from his student days that he hit students as well. When he was still active at the CBC, a university journalism program said, no, he can't, like, don't send your students to his program, because so it was known, but none of it was coming to light. And so five charges stuck, and that's the original trial. And there's actually still an outstanding charge. He's going to trial again in June with another individual who's bringing charges against him. But what was interesting about this was that, you know, when the judge in his findings, so he found Gian Gomeshi not guilty. He really laid out a framework of analysis, how he came to his decision, and it was really interesting. So, you know, this idea of presumption of innocence, sort of the basic presumption in a criminal proceedings, is that the accused is innocent until proven guilty. And then, so of course, the proof has to be provided beyond a reasonable doubt. And so his judgment was reasonable considering what happened in the trial. Unfortunately, the case was lost. You know, he sort of points out in his findings that it's essentially sort of, in especially historical cases like this, it's sort of two people's words against one another. And that so there's the only evidence really is the word of the victim. And so then the credibility of the accuser has to be established. Unfortunately, the three individuals that brought the charges against him really engaged in some misconduct, worrisome misconduct in the trial. So false memory in the one case. Lucy de Couture was involved in like just so many inconsistencies in her stories, withholding information. And the third one was sort of accused of playing chicken with the justice system. I'm only going to tell half the truth until I'm pressed into sort of revealing the rest of it. So their conduct in the courtroom was so concerning that, you know, he just decided there's no proof here that the case really relied on the veracity of what they said. And because they withheld information, and he even went as far to say things, outright deception. I mean, and that's potentially could lead to opening themselves up to countersuits from Gomeshi. Their conduct was really, really questionable. And in particular, this sort of collusion that they did with people in court cases aren't supposed to correspond with each other. And they did correspond with each other and really was apparent, you know, they wanted to bring him down. They were a team. They wanted to bring him down. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that feeling. Like, part of the scandal and the sense of betrayal was here was this guy who everybody looked up to, right? He's this feminist guy, nice guy, like, you know, sort of liberal guy, but it was a sham. And his behavior is angering and really wrong. But, you know, the judge sort of said, you know, their only job was to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And they actually didn't do that. They became consumed with bringing him down instead of consumed with just laying the story out in a factual way. So I hope the next trial goes better in terms of they're able to. I think if the witnesses had made had better conduct in the court, I think that some of the charges would have stuck. These are very serious charges, and he's guilty of them. I don't think there's any question about that. One thing the judge did say that I found slightly upsetting, you know, and this speaks to a lot of the discourse that's happening right now just around the unfairness in society and how difficult it is to report sexual assaults and so on. He said, each complainant engaged in conduct regarding Mr. Gomeshi after the fact, which seemed out of harmony with the assaultive behavior ascribed to him. So he's saying, you know, the women claimed he assaulted them and then they wrote him and said, you know, they were in love with him or wanted to continue the relationship or send him sexy pictures. And I think that's something that everyone can see as what's called a trauma bond, right? Or it's a very typical response to abusive treatment. And so it's known as a betrayal bond or a trauma bond, where being abused actually can lead people to seek out the abuser even more, that a bond is created that's incredibly painful and destructive, but very, very powerful. In that sense, I felt the judge made that statement a couple of times, and I felt like he was on thin ice on that a little bit, like, and maybe just out of touch. You know, mm-hmm. He is sort of like the older white guy judge, but overall, I think his decision was sound in terms of based on presumption of innocence and proof beyond a reasonable doubt, it wasn't there. So it's just a tragic turn of events in general, I think. Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Sarah. Let's open up this discussion. Emily, why don't we get your take on the results, and if you feel like hitting on some of Sarah's points, agreement, disagreement, feel free.
Sure. So I had a lot of thoughts and feelings when the case came out. And for me, I spent 2 years volunteering at an organization called Women in Crisis in Guelph, Ontario. Which they're quite similar to WAVA, Women Against Violence Against Women, here in Vancouver. I've been following the Gomeshi case quite closely since November, so that's kind of my background. And I look at this case in kind of two different ways. There's from the legal aspect, and then there's from my experience and sort of seeing, you know, how different systems treat survivors of sexual assault, whether it be, you know, the media, the courts, the legal system. And, you know, legally it does seem, in this case, there just wasn't enough proof beyond a reasonable doubt to convict Gomeshi. I really wasn't surprised when the verdict came out. I was kind of suspecting it beforehand, but I think it also speaks to the fact that the legal system really isn't set up to properly deal with sexual assault allegations. And, you know, you look at some of the things the judge said. He made a statement about how we should try to resist the assumption that all sexual assault complainants are true, when in fact that really isn't the case. I mean, anytime I've talked to people about sexual assault cases, I think their immediate reaction is, well, don't women lie about these things, when that's never the reaction to other types of violent crimes. And in fact, false sexual assault accusations are extremely low. Sexual assault is actually extremely underreported compared to other different types of crimes. And yeah, the system's just not set up to deal with it properly, I don't think.
Is you had mentioned that sexual assaults are consistently underreported. Is that something that you found, like, is this data you've managed to look at in Canada, or like, is this kind of a common trend all over?
Well, in Canada, they say it's under 10%, and that's based on different studies. Some suggest that it's even lower. So that's at least 90% of cases that aren't being reported. And from my personal experience of speaking to survivors, a lot of them don't report. And there's lots of different reasons, and it's because the legal system isn't set up to properly handle them. It might just be their word against someone else's. The whole legal system can be very re-traumatizing because they have to retell their stories. They often have to face their accuser. They often have to face public scrutiny over whether they're telling the truth or not. You look at the way these women were treated by the defense lawyer, how they were kind of sort of raked over the coals, and everything that they said was really challenged, which is understandable in a legal case, but you can understand how a survivor of sexual assault isn't going to want to go through that.
Mm-hmm. Eva, what are your thoughts on the legal system and its handling of sexual assault?
Yeah, I mean, I tend to agree with Emily, especially in terms of how the witnesses were treated by the defense attorney. And in this case, you really come out of it at the end having the impression that it was the witnesses that were put on trial and not Gomeshi. And I think that it's fair to say that that's going to discourage victims of sexual assault from coming forward in the future. And one of the things that's really standing out to me after this decision is people, you know, are saying the judge probably made the right call given what the evidence he had before him. And a lot of people saying, you know, if they had just told the truth from the beginning, this wouldn't have been an issue. And I think that's absolutely not true.
Why is that?
Well, I think if that they had come out from the beginning and said, oh, yeah, Gian Gomeshi assaulted me, but I continued to send him emails after on and to try to pursue a relationship, this case probably wouldn't have moved forward to trial at all. Public opinion would have, you know, would have been against them from the get-go. So I really, like, I don't think it's hard to understand why they might have felt extremely apprehensive about sharing some of these details, because people don't understand exactly how victims of sexual assault react after that. So I don't think it's fair to say if they had just told the whole truth from the beginning that this wouldn't have been a problem and we would have seen them as more credible.
Although, I mean, Sarah Lapsley had brought up that there was, we are, I think, in a time, at least in Canada, I can't say globally, we are in a time where we're a little bit more understanding. We have heard of, Sarah, you called it trauma bonds. I mean, or something similar like Stockholm syndrome, where you end up being, you know, in contact with whether it be an abuser or a kidnapper, mm-hmm. right? So, but then again, it's a question of whether the media, how they portray that, because you can mention that, yes, there is a real thing called trauma bonds. There is a real condition called Stockholm syndrome, where you end up still maintaining a relationship with the...
Yeah. I don't know if that's common knowledge, though.
Hmm.
I don't know if that's something that people generally accept and are aware of.
Perhaps it's the media's responsibility to make that the case?
Yeah, maybe. And people just should, you know, make themselves aware of it, too. But I think... Yeah, one thing to remember, too, is we say, okay, John Gomeshi was not convicted in court, but the court of public opinion has found him guilty.
Mm.
And that wasn't the case at first when the story first broke. First few days after he made the Facebook statement, the public was divided. A lot of people stood up for him, including, you know, people who worked with him at CBC, musical artists that worked with him. It wasn't until, you know... just the sheer numbers of women came forward, and Lucie de Couture put her name to her accusation, that public opinion, you know, turned against him. So I think, you know, it's hard to say that he's kind of learned his lesson from that, you know, he's been convicted in the court of public opinion as well, because, you know, people think he'll never work again in media again, but I don't think that's true either.
Emily, you had something to add.
Yeah, there was an article that came out recently, right before the verdict, and it was a few different PR experts said that they really think that Gomeshi can improve his public image, if you will, and will work in media again, especially the fact that he's been acquitted. And I think also, you know, this case has really been a national example, and it's really said... You know, if you're a sexual assault survivor, you're probably not going to get, you know, believed. You're probably not going to get a conviction. And I think it's going to discourage even more people from speaking out.
Hmm. What do you think of that, Sam? You've been quiet, brooding in the background here. Do you think there's any... what do you think of this idea of this court case setting a precedent for sexual assault survivors to not come out, perhaps?
I mean... I don't know that it sets a precedent. I think that it confirms a precedent that's basically already existed. Like, mm-hmm. like we've got this problem, and this is just, you know, it's one more thing where, you know, it's you know, emblematic of a problem that already exists. It's not breaking new ground in that mm-hmm. sense. I would add to the court of public opinion thing that, like, the court of public opinion has a very short memory. People still go to watch Woody Allen's movies. And still go to – they still smile when Remix to Ignition comes on. You know, like
– R. Kelly.
Kelly.
Yeah.
R. Kelly's music. You know, like you can be in like really just terrible – like you could be associated with really terrible things. And, you know, give it 10 years. Give it 20 years. You know, there will be a whole new generation of people to admire the things that you've done that have never heard of the bad things that you've done.
Well, look at Bill Cosby.
Yeah.
30 years ago, he was accused of what's finally, you know, coming
exactly.
to light now.
And that didn't even really get addressed until some stand-up comedian. I think it was Hannibal Buress who brought it up as a gag, as a punchline to one of his jokes. And that sort of, like, kicked the whole thing off again. Like... people forget really easily about this stuff, sort of as a society. There's always going to be people who remember it, but, like, in terms of the sort of, like, mass culture, that kind of thing, like, people forget way, way easier than we probably should. So, like, I don't know exactly where I'm going with this.
How about,
like,
we do have to wrap it up, guys, so... I think let's end on, like, maybe just one comment from each of you of what do you think... perhaps since we're all, like, at least four of us here are involved in the media, what should the media take away from this? What can we do, better or improve as a result of, you know, from this? Because this has been a media circus from 2 years, almost 2 years ago now. So, yeah, how about we start with Sam here, and then we'll go and end with Sarah.
I mean, I think a really important thing to take from how this is all sort of shaken out is, like, not to take, you know, people as either they're telling the truth or they're lying. Like, there are going to be inconsistencies with this stuff, and to understand that in how you report it. Like, this is not – it's not a simple cut and dry, you know, like, this person is either making everything up or they're telling the truth about everything. Like, something might – you know, there are going to be inconsistencies, and like understanding that moving forward, I think is a really important step, especially with the case in June. Like, I'm really curious to see how this affects the case that they build when that goes to trial, because obviously there are lessons to take from this for both sides.
Okay, and Eva.
Yeah, well, something that I found really interesting that relates to media is something Charlie Angus, an NDP MP, said. And he said that what he learned, one of the things he learned from this is that Gian flourished as a predator in what should have been the safest organization in the country. And I thought that was really interesting because you're surrounded by journalists. You know, you would think that that would be a safe environment. You know, you'd think that those would be the people that as soon as they kind of get a hint of something going on, that gets investigated further. So I hope that this means that the journalism community will be more wary of this in the future. And I get worried when we're idolizing people like this when, you know, that's not really the job of journalists. So that's my take on that.
Emily?
Yeah, I agree. I hope that it has a positive effect on how media covers these types of stories. I know Femifesto came out with this big report on how journalists should report about sexual assault allegations and survivors, which is an amazing resource. And I think all the statistics and knowledge is coming out, and there's really no excuse for people to be ignorant about it anymore, I don't think.
All right, Sarah, you get the last word.
No, I think it's been a really interesting conversation. I think, you know, what's important is that we just keep talking about it. And we're fortunate with social media and all kinds of alternative media that everyone does have an opportunity to sort of say what they think. This is now, you know, people are raising their voices. It's getting talked about. Everyone has, you know, different opinions, but what results from that is sort of a growth and moving forward. You know, frameworks, like, you know, the legal system is sort of a behemoth that's not going to change. It's not perfect, but it works, right? We're trying to protect all parties involved in a lawsuit. So I think it's, you know, how can we provide better protections?
For our last piece, we have co-director of News 101, Emily Blake, and her interview with Dr. Shona Nolan, a UBC professor, researcher, and expert on opioid addiction in BC.
Opioid addiction is a growing problem in Canada. With 64 fentanyl-related deaths this year, the province of British Columbia has declared a public health emergency. I spoke with Dr. Shona Nolan, a clinical assistant professor at the University of British Columbia, an addiction physician at St. Paul's Hospital, and a research scientist at the BC Centre for HIV/AIDS. She discussed fentanyl and opioid addiction in the province. If you could start by maybe explaining what exactly is fentanyl.
Fentanyl is a synthetic opioid, which means that its production does not rely on having to acquire the poppy plant. It used to be used historically mainly for sedation and pain control. It takes effect very, very quickly and has a very short half-life. And obviously, in the context of our current opioid overdose crisis situation, it has been making its way into the illicit drug market much more prevalently than prior to.
So why is it becoming such a problem now?
I'm not sure exactly in terms of why the timing of this, we're seeing this now, but there's a number of reasons why fentanyl seems to be an attractive option for drug manufacturers. The first is its production mainly occurs in international settings, kind of in and around Asia. And like I said, you don't need to acquire the poppy plant to produce it, so drug manufacturers can actually produce it in a lab. And it's about 50 to 100 times more powerful than morphine or more potent than morphine. And that's attractive mainly for drug traffickers because it makes it easier for them to smuggle smaller quantities of the drug across international borders. And then when it arrives here in Vancouver anyways, it's either sold as counterfeit heroin or it's pressed into counterfeit illicit prescription pills.
And is it an addictive substance?
Yes. It's addictive, just like heroin and morphine and any other opiate.
So in terms of its proper legal use, how safe is it?
It's as safe as any other opiate when it's used in the appropriate context and by the appropriate individual who has specialized training in its use, so either a physician or alternatively another healthcare provider.
And so we're hearing a lot of stories about people purchasing heroin and unknowingly getting fentanyl. Could you maybe tell me a bit about that?
Yeah, so that's mainly happening, like I mentioned, because when the product arrives, certainly here in Vancouver, it's being sold as counterfeit heroin or being pressed into illicit counterfeit pills. And so individuals may think that they're buying heroin or prescription pills when in fact it's actually a counterfeit product with fentanyl or it's being laced or adulterated with fentanyl in it.
And what are the dangers of that?
Well, because of the potency of fentanyl, even sort of a small misstep in the production of a product can result in a highly lethal or toxic or even fatal compound when that may not have been the intended consequence. The high potency also is a huge risk for the development of an overdose because fentanyl has significant respiratory depressing effects. So if a drug user is thinking that they're taking heroin, but in fact they take fentanyl, because it's 50 to 100 times more potent of a product, that significantly increases their risk for experiencing an overdose and potentially dying from that.
And so what does this public health emergency mean?
Basically, it's a step made by the provincial government that has really started to address and recognize the extent of the underlying problem. And fentanyl is just one small piece of a larger problem, with the larger problem being opiate addiction in general in this province. The details of exactly what the public health emergency means still remain a little bit to be seen. From my understanding, the provincial government is now going to be collecting data on not just overdoses that have resulted in a fatality, but all overdoses in more of a real-time situation, which means that members of the drug-using community or certain geographic areas that may be at high risk for an overdose will be fed that information in a more timely fashion than what was done previously.
And what could be done to combat this issue?
Well, I think, you know, I applaud the provincial government for taking this step. I think it's certainly a step in the right direction. I think there's a number of other treatment options that we should be doing and have been doing. The first, I think, is not underestimating the importance of education. So education not just for the drug-using community about the potential risks of unintentionally consuming fentanyl, but also education for the physicians who are prescribing opiates. A proportion of certainly the patients that I see who are currently using fentanyl or heroin or illicit prescription pills, their addiction originated after receiving a prescription from a physician or other healthcare provider. And so ensuring that physicians are prescribing opiates in an evidence-based fashion and putting the onus on the physician to ensure that their prescribing practices are in line with evidence-based practices is number one. Beyond education, I think improving access to evidence-based addiction treatment is key. So currently, individuals with an opioid use disorder can access either methadone or Suboxone. Methadone access can be very difficult in certain areas of the province that are outside of an urban setting. And with the knowledge that we have now of Suboxone being a safer alternative for opioid agonist treatment, I think really pushing for allowing physicians to prescribe Suboxone without them requiring to have a methadone license would be a huge step forward in improving access to this life-saving medication. And then lastly, I think improving access to evidence-based harm reduction strategies. So we here in Vancouver have access to a safe injection site through Insight, which is great, but we know every day patients are having to endure long wait lists or are being turned away from Insight because it's so heavily used on a day-to-day basis. And so really pushing for more of these evidence-based safe injection sites, as well as improving access and training to take home naloxone, I think are key to combating the current opioid overdose crisis.
So could you maybe explain what is it about opioids that makes them so addictive?
So, I mean, it acts in the same way that a lot of other substances do to produce an addiction, meaning that they sort of activate the reward pathway in our brain and result in the release of certain neurotransmitters or substances in the brain that induce a feeling of euphoria. And, you know, I think a lot of people think that addiction is a choice and not a disease. And while it may be someone's choice to take that first drug or take that first drink when you're thinking about alcohol, over time, that reward pathway really sort of takes over and the addiction really does become a chronic relapsing condition. So a disease like any other chronic disease, like hypertension or diabetes.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with me.
You're welcome.
That's all for the 2015 to 2016 edition of News 101. We'll be on hiatus for the summer, but if you would like to become involved and join our team, please send an email to news@citr.ca or volunteer@citr.ca. Remember, you do not have to have any journalism or radio experience to join our team. We provide you with all the training you need. See you in September. News 101 out.